Coming up, kicking off the Truth About Thyroid Week with Dr. Datis Karazian.
I'm Jimmy Moore, and this is the Living La Vida Low Carb Show.
Hey, and welcome back to the Living La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And we're up to episode 382. And yes, this week I wanted to do a special week of podcasts that deal with the subject of the thyroid. So many people have written to me over the years and said, hey, can you get a guest on your podcast to talk about thyroid function and why I'm still having symptoms of thyroid issues when my doctor tells me all the tests have come back normal? Well, today's guest, as well as Thursday's guest, will address this issue head on. Today's guest is Dr. Datis Karazian. His website is thyroidbook.com, and the book that he's mentioning there is the book that's aptly titled, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms When My Lab Tests Are Normal? And I really think you're going to like what you hear from Dr. Karazian today here on the Living La Vida Low Carb Show. But before we get into that interview, I wanted to share a brief mini interview that I did with the Secretary of Agriculture of the state of Maryland. This week, they are doing something very special. They are promoting people to go buy local foods from local farmers, farmers markets. They're really making a big deal about it up in the state of Maryland. And this is important because right now the United States Department of Agriculture is debating about what the dietary guidelines for 2010 will be. And here is a state that's kind of taken the bull by the horns themselves and decided to say, you know what? Eating real local foods is the way to go. And I'm so pleased to welcome the Secretary of Agriculture. His name is Earl Hance. Today I have with us the Secretary of Agriculture in the state of Maryland. His name is Earl Hance, and we are so privileged to have him here today. He's going to tell us about a program that is happening this week in his state. Welcome to the show.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be here.
Well, tell us a little more about this third annual Buy Local event that is happening thanks to the Governor Martin O'Malley there along with First Lady Katie O'Malley. What is this about? What is the Buy Local Challenge Week all about?
Well, we're very fortunate that Governor O'Malley and the First Lady are very committed to helping agriculture in Maryland, and one of the best ways to support agriculture in Maryland is to help our local farmers.
Right.
And we've come up with a program, the Buy Local program, which encourages our citizens to go out and support our local farmers at farmers markets and roadside stands and anywhere that local products are retailed. And there's so many positives in this program that it's got the governor and the first lady and the whole administration very excited. You know, it doesn't just help our local farmers by adding profit in their enterprises, but people get good, fresh, the best tasting and highest quality produce from their local farmers. We reduce the amount of carbon footprint that we have because we don't have to truck in products
right.
from all around the East Coast or even from the West Coast. And it keeps the money in the local economies and keeps our open space. So the governor is just very excited about the program, and for the last 3 years has held this picnic there at the State House in Annapolis.
Right.
And we invite people in to kick off the Buy Local Challenge, which is next week, where we encourage all the citizens in Maryland to have at least one local product in one of their meals every day for a week.
Wow. That is awesome. That is so awesome. Now, what was the motivation for this? Was it economics because you need the money in your local economy? Was it more about health? And I don't know what the health is like in the state of Maryland, but I know in my home state of South Carolina, we're really fat down here.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure it's a multiplicity of reasons why they would be promoting a buy local type of program.
Right. And what we found out through our program is we also started 2 years ago an initiative to get more local products into schools, and we call that our Farm to School program.
Yeah.
And what we have found is there's two very interesting components to that program. When our children get to taste fresh products at their ripest and most highest nutritional value, they want to eat more vegetables. You know, when they eat things that have been processed or prepared, you know, it just loses a little bit of its real flavor. So when we get them engaged in eating local products, they eat more of those. And the other benefit to the program is that it gives us an opportunity to educate those children on where their food actually comes from.
Exactly. Because not many kids or adults even know where their food comes from.
That's right. When you ask many small children today where your food comes from, they'll tell you a grocery store.
The honest answer.
That's right. And we want to make sure that they clearly understand that when they ride up and down the road and they see the cows in the field or the farmers in the field, that that's where their food truly comes from.
Now, are you aware of any other states that are doing this kind of event, or are you guys unique to this?
Well, I think there are some other states with some similar programs.
Right.
You know, we like to say we're leaders, and, you know, I think that we have done a pretty good job the last 2 years, not to pat ourselves on the back, but I think the last 2 years we have really done an extensive outreach program to really get this thing off the ground and running, and so far it's been excellent.
Now, what have the farmers been saying to all this? I'm sure they're just loving this.
Exactly. We've seen a tremendous increase in farmers markets, and that gives our farmers more opportunity to sell their products. It gives other farmers who may have been looking for other avenues to generate income for their farms an opportunity. And even for people that maybe retired or wanted to change in the way they live their life and have a little bit of acreage, you know, if you can retail your products, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of land
right, to
generate an income.
Exactly. Now, you guys have been doing this for the past 3 years. I'm sure the reverberation from it goes well beyond the July week-long event.
Absolutely. This is just sort of a campaign to make the citizens of Maryland aware that right now we're in the peak of our season. Everything is available now, but we'll have local products up until November. We'll have certain items that are still coming off our fields, farms, and so this is just kind of highlight, get people thinking about it if they haven't already done so.
Right. Now, if people are interested in learning more about the programs that you are doing, you do have the State of Maryland website, mda.state.md.us. I'll have a link to that in the show notes section at theliveinlowcarbshow.com/show notes. Well, Secretary Hance, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show, and kudos to Maryland for getting it. I really wish more states would understand that, you know, local is where it's at. It really is the future, I believe, of our economy and of our food supply in the years to come.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and we really appreciate you allowing us to get this information out. And there, we do have another website that's more direct for your listeners.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And it would be www.marylandsbest.net.
Marylandsbest.net. We got it.
Right. And if they go to that website, they can get a listing of farmers markets near them and farmers retail stands, and there's a lot of good local information on there. So we encourage all your listeners to go there and check that out, because people don't realize how close good food is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just recently found a farmer about 4 or 5 months ago, and he was 10 miles from my house, and I didn't even know he existed. So.
Yep.
And
yep.
They're out there. So we'll keep up the great work.
Well, thank you.
And now, without further delay, let's get into my interview with Dr. Datis Karazian. Welcome back to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And you know what? A lot of you guys have written to me and said, Jimmy, you've got to get somebody on your show to talk about thyroid. We hear so much conflicting information out there. You need to do this. You need to do that. All your lab tests are normal, and yet I'm still having issues. What's going on? I need an expert that really knows his stuff. Well, today we have one such expert. His name is Dr. Datis Karazian. Did I say that right? Karazian.
That's right, Karazian.
Very good. So glad to have you today, Dr. Karazian. He teaches more than 50 seminars nationally and internationally to healthcare practitioners. He has published numerous professional papers, several clinical manuals, and over 30 educational CDs. In other words, this guy knows his stuff. He's pulled together all this extensive research and clinical experience to provide a revolutionary breakthrough in the support of low thyroid function. He has taught thousands of doctors how to successfully use these methods, and he's written a book entitled, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms When My Lab Tests Are Normal? He has a private practice in San Diego, California, and he's here today on the Living La Vida Low Carb Show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the healthcare industry. What was it that drew you to want to practice medicine?
Well, actually, I practiced natural health care, and what happened with me was when I was younger, I had a back injury, and no one was helping me. I went to a chiropractor, and he helped me, so I decided that was great, and I wanted to be a chiropractor. And then when I started my chiropractic practice, I was doing a lot of nutrition, and I was seeing so many people that just weren't being helped pharmaceutically, being helped with nutrition, so my interest grew, and then I went back to school and got my master's degree in human nutrition. And then as I got more interested in natural medicine, I kept seeing the discrepancies of what was being done with patients in the healthcare model and the options that were available alternatively. So I then pursued a doctor of health science so I can understand health science research more and learn about statistics and study designs. And after that, I got my master's degree in neuroscience. And one of the things that was very obvious to me is once I learned to evaluate research and look at the healthcare system, there is definitely a mismatch between research that was being published about things related to thyroid and other types of health conditions and what was actually being done from a pharmaceutical level and the options that were available from a natural medicine model. And it's very clear that we don't really have an evidence-based model, that we really do have this pharmaceutical influence model, and that really led the interest into all types of areas. And the thyroid was something that just I got interested in because so many of the people I was working with had thyroid disorders, taking thyroid replacement, but still having every single symptom.
Right. Wouldn't you agree the whole pharmaceutical model pretty much dominates the entire healthcare industry?
Yes, it does. And you know, one of the things that anyone can do is they can go to different web pages that explain the top 50 prescribed drugs, and you can just Google that. And if you actually look at the mechanism of the top 50 most prescribed drugs, you'll see that the drug is there to really either downregulate, block, or inhibit a physiological system.
Right.
So we have things like beta blockers, HMG coreductase inhibitors, protein pump inhibitors, serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It becomes very clear that the current model, the tools that are being used for patients, are these agents that actually shut down the body.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big differences between, I think, natural medicine and pharmaceutical. I mean, natural medicine and the pharmaceutical model is because in natural medicine, you're trying to upregulate, enhance function, and then the pharmaceutical model, you're trying to shut down. Plus, we have this very simple single symptom, single drug, or single diagnosis, single drug model, and the whole complexity of this picture doesn't really get accounted for. And this is especially true with individuals that have the thyroid and metabolic disorders.
And it's disheartening that the natural food solution sometimes for people is totally ignored.
It's completely ignored. There's really very little training in conventional medical programs for nutrition and diet. And you know, when you talk to the average physician, they just don't have a clue about anything published in journals that are related to natural medicine. They have no clue with dietary intake. And unfortunately, when they're clueless, they make it seem like there's no research or evidence on the material, and that's not the fact.
Do you see that changing anytime soon with doctors realizing, hey, something's not working about this system with the drugs that we're prescribing? We're having to prescribe drugs to cover up the side effects of that other drug, and it seems like there's got to be a breaking point at some point.
Well, I think what we're seeing is every year we're seeing that people are spending more money for alternative medicine than conventional medicine. This has been a trend for the past 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the public is just more educated now than ever before.
Sure.
And the fact of this person wearing a white coat, having all the answers, is no longer accepted. People are doing their own research and they're demanding more. Now, in the healthcare system, if someone's in an HMO model, you know, it's very unlikely anything will change, because they set standards and care. But in private practice, and what people are demanding is changing healthcare. And at some point, there's going to be practitioners that are dinosaurs that people are just not going to go to, and then there's going to be those that are more involved. But the other hand is, it's not just that the medicine has to change. It's that the public is happy with trying to take one single pill to fix everything.
Right.
And I don't see a big change in the healthcare system because, in general, the average person is looking for a simple solution without doing dietary and lifestyle change to fix their health problems.
Right. So yeah, unfortunately, we do live in that kind of culture where people want a pill to fix them rather than doing the due diligence of making lifestyle changes that are important for their health.
That's right. So I personally don't predict much change, not because of the healthcare system, but because of people's mindset of trying to take one single pill to fix everything.
Well, we're doing our best to try to help change that mindset with this show and some of the other podcasts and blogs and things out there that are really educating people that there are alternative solutions to their health problems besides that statin drug to lower their cholesterol, quote unquote, lower their cholesterol and those kinds of things. Definitely there are alternatives available if people have their eyes open to them.
Absolutely, and those type of people that are looking for that information will be the ones that will find your show and you know, find the things that we all do, and that's great, you know. So the people that are in search for it, there's solutions for, and the people that want the single pill, and they'll just be stuck in the healthcare system doing what they do and feeling the way they do. So it's all going to, you know, impact people that are ready for it, and people that aren't ready for it will just be stuck in the system. I just think there's more people that aren't ready for the change than people that are.
Sure. Well, you actually are doing something about it with your book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms When My Lab Tests Are Normal? You have an accompanying website with that if people are interested in checking it out. It's thyroidbook.com, and when you go there, you can see all about this book and lots of resources from Dr. Karazian. And tell us a little bit about, let's just dive right into thyroid, because it's talked about a lot. People say, oh, I have a bad thyroid, and so that's why I can't lose weight. Tell us what the thyroid is and what its function is supposed to be.
A thyroid gland is a gland in front of the your neck, and it's really involved with making a hormone called T3 and a hormone called T4.
Mm-hmm.
And these hormones are there to increase the metabolic rate. And the metabolic rate is really important because it's what you need to, let's say, burn body fat or have energy and have your cells function. And a lot of people have thyroid disorders where they are diagnosed hypothyroid. So at some point, they have depression, they have weight loss. They have inability to have weight loss, they have hair loss. And they go and see the doctor, and they may get the diagnosis of hypothyroid. What people don't know very well, and what's not being really promoted in the healthcare system, is that the etiology, the mechanism for why people actually develop a thyroid disorder, is actually an autoimmune response. And the literature is very clear with this. About 90% or more of people that have a thyroid disorder really have an autoimmune disease. And these people have antibodies that are obviously seen with laboratory tests for their thyroid. Now, in the current healthcare model, they don't check the thyroid antibodies. All they do is put these individuals on thyroid hormones, and they're just diagnosed hypothyroid. And they do this because the antibody testing, whether it's positive or negative, doesn't change their treatment. All they would be given is thyroid hormones for the rest of their life. But if the antibodies were checked, then it would be very clear that they have an autoimmune disease. And unfortunately, when people have this autoimmune disease, is actually what's called Hashimoto's hypothyroidism.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're taking replacement, it doesn't have much of an effect for them, because one of the things that's been clearly published is when people have this autoimmune disease, the autoimmune reaction is creating this inflammatory immune response, and these proteins called cytokines are elevated, and these cytokines make these thyroid receptor sites not respond to thyroid hormones. So despite the fact they're taking thyroid hormones, they're not getting a thyroid receptor site effect, so they're not changing their metabolic rate. That's why you have these individuals that are diagnosed hypothyroid taking thyroid hormones, and they still have difficulty with weight loss, they still have depression, they still have every single symptom. But on lab work, it looks like they have thyroid hormones in their bloodstream, but the autoimmunity itself is now allowing these thyroid hormones to be expressed. And this is why there's just so much frustration with thyroid patients, because they've been diagnosed. They're hoping that since they're taking thyroid hormones that all their symptoms would go away, but it doesn't. And part of the problem with this is the autoimmunity is not being identified, and there really is no pharmaceutical options for these individuals, meaning that when you look at autoimmune disease from a conventional model, the first line of therapy are steroids, like prednisone, mm-hmm. corticosteroids. And from a cost-benefit ratio, it was established that thyroid patients should not be on corticosteroids because it's too the adverse effects of it are not worth the benefits. And the way they would manage this condition is just to give them thyroid hormones over time. And one of the things that takes place with thyroid patients is they have to have their thyroid monitored every 6 months to a year. Mm-hmm. And most patients don't understand why. And the reason why is because their immune system is predicted to destroy their thyroid gland more and more every year, every 6 months. So they're constantly trying to play this catch-up game of trying to give them replacement to compensate for the thyroid destruction that's going to take place over time and time. They're not doing anything for the autoimmunity because steroids are too adverse for them. And then the autoimmunity is making these thyroid receptor sites not respond. So unfortunately, these people have no benefits, and there's nothing being done for the mechanism of the condition from a conventional model. And this is where alternative medicine really shines, because we can do a lot of things to modulate the autoimmunity and the things that are triggering the thyroid disorder that can really make some major improvements in people's health. And this is what we cover in the book.
Sure. So if somebody, and I've got to admit, most people probably don't know that they have a thyroid issue. What are some of the signs that they need to be on the lookout for?
Well, it's people that have thyroid disorders, depends on what stage they have the disorder, but the first thing I think people will notice is they just don't have the zest that they used to when they get out of bed and they start getting to the day. They just get fatigued sooner. They have depression. They start having hair loss. They exercise, but they can't lose weight. They get constipation. Sometimes they get morning headaches. They have hair thinning. Those are the most typical, those are the most common signs you'll see as someone starts to become hypothyroid. Now, when people start becoming hypothyroid, the autoimmunity usually is what's turned on. They start attacking their thyroid. And in the initial stages of hypothyroidism, their thyroid lab testing may not be obvious. And one of the things that they do conventionally to identify a hypothyroid condition is they look at this laboratory marker called thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH. And if the TSH is elevated, they're diagnosed hypothyroid. Well, in the early stages, the TSH will fluctuate. So in a few days, it'll show hypothyroid patterns, and then a few days it won't. And then it'll show hypothyroid, and it won't. But the antibodies are positive. So one of the things that that's recommended for individuals that are having these symptoms that may have not have had their thyroid checked, but they're told nothing is wrong with their thyroid, is to really request and have their thyroid antibodies checked. And there's two antibodies. One's called TPO antibody, and the other one is called thyroglobulin antibody. So those need to be checked. Now, it's sometimes difficult to get a conventional practitioner to run these tests, especially in an HMO setting. But those are the things that would be ideal to check. And if that's there, the literature is very clear that these people will have thyroid failure in the future and that it is an autoimmune reaction and it will turn into a thyroid disorder.
So what's this business about taking your temperature for testing how your thyroid is functioning and getting the temperature up? Is there any merit to that?
Well, this is something, the temperature testing was something that was first put together by Dr. Barnes back in 1976, and it truly is an outdated concept, and a lot of people are still stuck in 1976. A lot of healthcare practitioners are still stuck there, and we know that the temperature can change from many things. It can change from anemia, so it can change from progesterone deficiencies, it can change from testosterone deficiencies. So one of the things is, you know, back in 1976, there really weren't good laboratory testing. There wasn't efficient ways to test these things, and that was one of the better ways to evaluate a thyroid. Now we know that we have great lab testing. We have the ability to check several different thyroid markers, and then we can really look at these things without having to deal with this temperature issue. And ranges, we know with thyroids differ. There is no acceptance of what TSH should be, meaning if you look at the standards from the American Thyroid Association or the Endocrine Society or the American Academy of Family Physicians, you'll see that the TSH levels are all different. Some people say it should be about 5 to be hypothyroid. Some will say it's 4.0. Some will say it's 3.5. So one of the things that that we've done in the book is we talk about the lower ranges, the functional ranges, the tight ranges. You'll see this stuff. And typically, if you look at someone with a very good functional tight range for hypothyroid, you can identify these things very quickly. You don't really have to resort to a temperature testing model, which right. can really be so many other things than just thyroid.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, I am looking at a hormone evaluation that I had of my thyroid function. I did this just for kicks, knowing I would be interviewing you. And I took a look at the test results, and I'm all within the normal range. Free T4 was 1.4, free T3 was 4.6, TSH 1.3, and TPO was 6. By all intents and purposes, I've been told that's pretty spectacular for thyroid function, all of those numbers. And yet I have a lot of those symptoms that you talked about earlier regarding a poor thyroid function. So what do you say to somebody who comes back with test results like that that are seemingly great and yet still having those symptoms?
Well, a couple things. I don't think you had all the markers checked. You should have had thyroglobulin checked. You should have had reverse T3 checked. Those sometimes show these. We also know that thyroid antibodies fluctuate mm-hmm. with autoimmunity in the early stages, so sometimes we have to check those again. But there's also one of the biggest mimickers of hypothyroid symptoms exactly is metabolic syndrome.
Mm.
And metabolic syndrome is basically, you know, related to the topic that, you know, your following has a lot of interest in, which is this whole insulin blood sugar type of mechanism.
Right.
So we know that, especially in females, when they have insulin resistance and they have too much carbohydrates and not enough physical activity in their diet, that they get these insulin surges. And these insulin surges in a female stimulate the thecal cells of the ovaries to put out testosterone. And when a female has this insulin testosterone activity, they actually have hair loss, inability to lose weight, depression of every single symptom of hypothyroid. So they're not hypothyroid. With a male, it's a little bit different, but the same kind of basic concept here. They have an insulin surge, but with males, the insulin surges increase their estrogen levels. There's an enzyme called aromatase. So as men get insulin surges, they start converting their testosterone to estrogen. And when men start converting their testosterone to estrogen, they also have hypothyroid symptoms. So if we see a person that comes in and they have every single hypothyroid symptom and we're just not seeing anything there, then there's a possibility that they have this blood sugar type of disorder. And then we look at those types of markers. So looking at fasting glucose and triglycerides, estrogen levels in a male, testosterone levels in a female can sometimes be the clue of why they may have these symptoms that may look like thyroid but in fact aren't thyroid.
Hmm. Yeah, I was really interested on page 98 of your book where you talked about hypoglycemia being linked to all forms of hypothyroidism. I didn't really think about that before, but you explain it very well and the symptoms to look for. Why is that?
Okay, well, there's when you look at the blood sugar component to thyroid disorders, there's two aspects here. One is just what we just talked about, which is there's people that have blood sugar disorders, and because of the blood sugar disorders, they can have these testosterone surges if they're females, estrogen surges if they're males, and have all the same symptoms. But then there's a whole other aspect to this, which are people that are confirmed hypothyroid and have Hashimoto's. And when individuals have this autoimmune reaction against their thyroid, again, which is number one cause for being hypothyroid, when they get insulin surges, the insulin surge itself has been shown to be a trigger for the autoimmune attack. So when a person's hypoglycemic and their blood sugar levels drop and they get shaky, lightheaded, and irritable, there's two hormones that are released. One's cortisol and the other one's insulin, and these hormones are there to try to get their blood sugar back to normal. But the insulin surge itself then triggers the autoimmune attack. And other individuals who are on the high blood sugar side, when they eat a meal and they have too much carbs and they fatigue and they're about to pass out or need some coffee to get through the day, they're also getting insulin surges, and those insulin surges, again, stimulate the thyroid. So one of the things I usually do with the patients I work with is I tell them if they have a Hashimoto's hypothyroid, and if they're hypoglycemic, I say, listen, every time you get shaky, lightheaded, and irritable, you're promoting an autoimmune reaction. You're going to lose part of your thyroid gland, and you're never going to get it back. And if they're insulin resistant and they fatigue after meals, I tell them, listen, every time you eat a meal and you fatigue and pass out, you're really promoting your autoimmune attack, and you're going to have some long-term effects with this. And if you're doing this every single meal, every single day, it's going to really deteriorate your thyroid because you're promoting the autoimmunity. So the blood sugar disorder itself can be one of the triggers that stimulates the activation of the Hashimoto's immune response.
Right. Okay, so from a dietary perspective, I was looking through like pages 104 through 110 or so. It looks like you put out a lot of good information for people that are interested in not only controlling the thyroid function issues, but also the hyperinsulinemia, hypoglycemia, insulin resistance. Tell us a little bit about the diet plan that you're helping people with.
Okay, well, so one of the things that we always try to do when we see a thyroid disorder is one of the battles is we have to decrease the triggers that have been shown to cause the autoimmune reaction to flare up. And from a dietary perspective, there's two main things. One of them is there's a strong association between thyroid disorders, Hashimoto's, thyroid disorders, and gluten intolerance. So a lot of these individuals have gluten intolerance. Mm-hmm. And we know that the gene type, the HLA-DQ genotype number 2 and 8, is very commonly associated with thyroid disorder. So the most common cross-antibody that people will have when they have a thyroid disorder are gluten antibodies or transglutaminase antibodies. And this gluten exposure really promotes the autoimmune attack very, very severely. And there's been paper after paper after paper published that really shows that people that have thyroid disorders, if they eat gluten, that their autoimmunity is promoted. And when they become gluten-free, that they see resolution of their symptoms and lab markers dramatically improve. And in the book itself, I think I have close to 600-700 peer-reviewed references just to make sure that I didn't want the book to be an opinion. I just wanted the book to be a compilation of all the research that we use clinically and the ways that patients can or people that are reading the book can find use for it.
Yes, so, well-resourced. Good job.
Thank you. So the gluten component is one of the dietary things, and that's important to us because it's not just that they're eating too much carbs, but it's the fact they're having any carbs. And in a sense, when with carbs, I don't mean the starch aspect of it, but the gluteadin aspect of it, the protein response in wheat, oats, rye, barley, kamut, spelt, that has been shown to be a trigger for this. So we look at these individuals that have thyroid disorders and go, okay, you can't have gluten. And then the second thing is we have to stabilize their blood sugar. So when they come in, usually when you look at people that have thyroid disorders, you look at them and see what their body composition is. And usually if you see that they're overweight, they tend to be more on the insulin-resistant side, and they're the ones that usually fatigue after meals, and the glucose is a little bit higher than normal. You know, the normal range we use is above 100, and heading towards diabetes, which is the overweight ones. The people that have thyroid disorders that are not overweight, that are normal weight, typically are the ones that are hypoglycemic. They're the ones that get shaky, lightheaded, irritable, and have to eat. And one of the easiest ways to distinguish whether someone's hypoglycemic or insulin resistant is when we do a history on them, is just to see how they feel after they eat. If they eat a meal and they get tired and fatigued, we know they're insulin resistant. if they eat a meal and they feel normal and they can function again, we know that they're hypoglycemic. What's normal for a person after they eat a meal is there's no change in energy and they just feel like they're not hungry anymore. And I got to tell you, working with thyroid patients, I've not to this day seen a hypothyroid patient that didn't have the blood sugar component to their case. So there is this blood sugar component to the case. Now, if they're insulin resistant and they fatigue after meals, then, you know, the goal is to cut down on, you know, their starch intake and have them do physical activity and limit their carbohydrates, to make it very simple. And if they're hypoglycemic, then the goal is to have them eat more frequently and have them have more of a protein-rich source throughout the day than a sugar rich source, a simple sugar source throughout the day, and make sure they don't have big gaps between meals. So if we can get them off gluten, stabilize their blood sugar, there's a decrease in the autoimmune reaction against their thyroid, and then they start to feel better.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the suggestion on page 105 where you say, find your carbohydrate tolerance and stick to it. Here is one simple rule. If you feel sleepy or crave sugar after you're done eating, you know what? You've eaten way too many carbohydrates.
That's right. One of the things, you know, we don't do is we don't give people like a dietary suggestion for how much carbohydrates they should eat. Because everyone's different. Everyone has their own degree of insulin resistance. And, you know, it's very clear. If you, a person eats a meal, they get tired afterwards, they had too much of a load for their body, and they just have to work with that. And there's some individuals that will cut down all their carbs and basically be on a lean protein vegetable diet, and they still have fatigue after meals, and those are sometimes the more severe insulin resistance people. And for those people, we really have to push nutrients that stimulate their insulin receptor sites, things like vanadium, alpha-lipoic acid, B vitamins, and inositol. Those things really get those receptor sites to respond, and then we load them up on those things to the point where the fatigue after meal goes away, and once we start seeing that change, we'll start seeing the glucose and triglycerides and lipid panels all start to normalize.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about supplements, what role they play in this whole equation with normalizing thyroid function.
Well, when you look at supplementation, there isn't like a specific nutrient that we use. And one of the issues that always comes up with the thyroid is there's this great demand for practitioners and the public to use iodine to support their thyroid.
Right.
And for Hashimoto's people, it's actually been very clear that it makes them worse.
Really?
And yes. Wow. And what we know is, and there's paper after paper published on this, and I actually wrote an article on this for the webpage, thyroidbook.com, and I listed all the research on this because usually when you tell people that, they just don't believe you. And, you know, we are really stuck in the 1960s model when we look at the thyroid. And maybe back in 1960, iodine deficiency and was one of the causes for thyroid disorders. But in 2010, autoimmunity is definitely the main cause for thyroid disorders. And iodine stimulates an enzyme in the thyroid called TPO. And TPO is what's used to make thyroid hormones. But with Hashimoto's, which is the most common cause for thyroid disorders, the pathophysiology of the condition is that the immune system is actually attacking TPO. And it's very clear to see many people that go on iodine with thyroid disorders, they get nervousness, they get anxiety, they get palpitations, they get thyroiditis, they get flare-ups. So iodine is really not the way to go with these cases. And they're not hypothyroid because they're iodine deficient. They're hypothyroid because their immune system is attacking their thyroid. And it's really clear to see that with them. You know, you check their iodine levels, it's fine. You people who are iodine deficient as a cause for hypothyroidism, usually they have a goiter or an enlargement of their thyroid gland. They just don't have it today. Most people have thyroid disorders don't have a goiter or an enlargement. So when it comes to, like, supplementation for the thyroid, the first thing we do is make sure they're not taking iodine because it tends to be something that really flares us up. And there's several studies on this. I would say maybe 30, 40 studies on this now worldwide. I've listed the major ones, again, on the thyroidbook.com. There's a newsletter section on past articles. And then there's a few I mentioned in the book. So we kind of look at the nutritional approach, the first thing we actually do isn't thinking about what supplements to give them, is which supplements to exclude. The other thing we do when it comes to exclusion of supplements is with autoimmune disorders, there's what's called a Th1 dominance or Th2 dominance.
Right.
There's two parts to the immune system. The Th1 part of the immune system is what attacks foreign invaders, and the Th2 system is the part of the immune system that makes antibodies. And this is important to us because when people develop an autoimmune disease, they tend to have a dominance to either the Th1 side or the Th2 side. And this is critical because certain supplements stimulate the Th1 side and certain supplements stimulate the Th2 side. Things that are typically used for the common cold or flu, like echinacea and astragalus and maitake mushroom, stimulate the Th1 side. Things that like are used as antioxidants, grape seed extract, green tea extract, these types of things stimulate the Th2 side. So a lot of times you'll see people that have these chronic thyroid disorders out of desperation have all of these supplements they're trying to take, and some of them are Th1 or Th2 stimulators that are actually making their condition worse. So from a nutritional perspective, the first thing that I do is I try to see if they are getting exposed to triggers for the thyroid. So we look for Th1, Th2-based supplements. We look for iodine and then see if any of those are there. Now, when it comes to nutrients that we give them, the inclusion model versus the exclusion model,
right.
These people clearly have been shown to have vitamin D need.
Yeah.
And vitamin D is really not a vitamin. It's a hormone. And it's a hormone that has very powerful effects on what are called regulatory T cells. And regulatory T cells are these T cells that modulate the immune system. They modulate the Th1, Th2 system. They modulate autoimmunity. And it's really the area that is being looked at in the pharmaceutical model to try to deal with autoimmune disease. They're trying to develop drugs to stimulate the regulatory T cells. Vitamin D is a very powerful stimulator of regulatory T cells. And vitamin D deficiencies are really, really common. And we also know that about 90% of Hashimoto's people actually have a vitamin D receptor site polymorphism, or what that means is they have a gene uniqueness where they need more vitamin D than the average person.
Yeah.
And there's some immunologists that have theorized that there's that part of the genotype that makes a person susceptible to an autoimmune thyroid disorder is potentially the fact that they can't get the regulatory T cell activity up because of their vitamin D polymorphisms. So a lot of times nutrients that are very helpful for thyroid patients is vitamin D. We're talking about 6 to 10,000 IUs a day.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, these should be measured with a 25-hydroxy vitamin D test.
Right.
And the levels we like to see them are between 50 and 100. The lab range is usually around. Anything below 30 is considered low. You know, so we like to get them above that range.
Yeah.
And that's very helpful for them. Now, other nutrients that we typically use for thyroid disorders really depends on the mechanism. So some of these individuals have hypoglycemia, so these individuals have insulin resistance. Some of these individuals have what's called leaky gut syndrome. Some of these people have infections. And so we try to use supplements that are specific for their Th1, Th2 system and try to get their regulatory T cells up. We try to repair their intestinal lining. We try to stabilize their blood sugar, and we try to get them off the supplements that are promoting the flare-ups like the iodine or supporting their immune system the wrong way. And it seems to be very effective.
Hmm. Yeah, I have become very interested in the whole vitamin D connection to health over the past couple of years. I measured my vitamin D level 2 years ago. It was 42, which was what they would say in the good range between what 40 and 60 they say is good. But I had some issues, various issues, so I thought, you know what, let's try taking the 10,000 IU of D3 gel caps a day. Because I had interviewed somebody, talked about that. So I tried it, and within 6 months, it went from 42 to 68.
Yeah, works.
And so I backed off a little bit from that for the next 6 months, down to about 5,000 IU a day, and it dropped again to 50. So now I'm back up on 10,000. It's finding that level, and I appreciate hearing you say that. Some people have issues with getting enough vitamin D where they have to have a higher dose than, I mean, the RDA of vitamin D is just woefully inept.
Yeah, the RDA for vitamin D is for bone loss prevention for World War II soldiers. that's what the RDA for vitamin D is. So, you know, that's not really what we need. We need a much higher level. And this has been so proven in the literature that we have gross vitamin D deficiencies all over the country, even in areas where there's plenty of sunlight. My practice in sunny San Diego, we have severe vitamin D deficiencies here. And we know that it's just not sunlight exposure, but that people that have increased body fat, people that have severe stress, people that have chronic inflammation, they can't utilize sunlight to make vitamin D. So a lot of people are having these mechanisms involved with their overall health. So just being exposed to the sun is not enough.
Yeah.
We also know that when you look at how people are taught about vitamins and supplements, they're told to be very cautious of taking vitamins that are fat soluble, like vitamin D, and not to overdose, and they can be serious health problems. And one of the things we know is it's just not accurate with vitamin D and vitamin A, and that people can really take high levels and the notion that this is dangerous is really being disproven, and a lot of people need these higher doses, and the RDAs are just not really sufficient for what we see out there today.
Right, which is why the work that you're doing is so important, because people need to hear the truth about things like vitamin D and the levels that are appropriate for them. So,
absolutely.
Well, let's talk about your very unique fast for unwinding insulin resistance. I think this will be acutely and of great interest to this audience. This really intrigued me, Dr. Karasian.
Sure.
The fast. Tell us the purpose of the fast and how does it help with unwinding insulin resistance?
Okay. Well, if we look at insulin resistance. Insulin resistance was first called prediabetes, and the individuals that had glucose levels that were starting to be elevated were told they had prediabetes. And then later on, they changed the name to Syndrome X, mm-hmm. because they realized that people that had these elevated glucose levels had a severe cardiovascular risk, and they started to see this connection, and they called it Syndrome X. And then now it's no longer called prediabetes or syndrome X. It's really referred to as metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. And metabolic syndrome is really a syndrome because we know that when people have elevated blood sugar levels, that their entire neuroendocrine immune axis is involved. So several things take place with this whole metabolic syndrome that, you know, or insulin resistance pattern. And one of them is that as individuals have their insulin levels go up, their cortisol levels go up. And as the cortisol levels go up, that promotes further insulin resistance. And then as they get insulin resistance, they get greater insulin surges, which then stimulates them to produce more cortisol. Insulin is a stimulant for the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So they get one vicious cycle, which is this insulin-cortisol vicious cycle. Okay? And what happens is they have several vicious cycles. And then the other things that happen is, well, like we mentioned earlier, is these insulin surges in men stimulate the enzyme aromatase, so they convert testosterone into estrogen in males. And then in females, these insulin surges stimulate 17-20-lyase, which converts their hormones into testosterone, their pre-existing DHEA into testosterone. So females get these insulin resistance surges with high testosterone, and males with high estrogen. And we also know that when a female gets high testosterone, that actually creates insulin resistance. And when a male gets high estrogen, that actually creates insulin resistance. So then they get this another vicious cycle. They have these hormonal surges creating insulin resistance. They have the cortisol creating insulin surges. And the other thing that we know is that when individuals have these high cortisol and insulin levels, that there's a cytokine called interleukin-6 that's released. And this makes them have their Th2 system become overzealous, which makes them have their antibody system become overzealous, so they start developing food sensitivities. And this is part of the whole pathophysiology of metabolic syndrome. And the other thing that we know is that individuals that have the whole metabolic syndrome, these cortisol surges, their inflammatory cascade creates what's called a leaky gut, where they have an intestinal permeability problem, that their tight junctions in their intestinal tract are no longer there, and food particles that shouldn't go through the intestinal cells go through, and this creates an immune inflammatory response. So if we take a look at insulin resistance, we can't look at it and go, well, they just need chromium. You just need to cut down on carbs. That there's really this vicious cycle, this vicious syndrome that's taking place, that they have these hormonal issues that are being promoted by insulin, which is then creating more insulin resistance with the cortisol, testosterone, estrogen. Their insulin surges are having impacts on the immunity, so they're getting food sensitivities, their intestinal barrier is being compromised. And the other thing that we know that takes place with these insulin surge metabolic syndrome patterns is the fact that they're insulin resistant. They can't get glucose into their cells, and they can't make what's called glucuronic acid. This is a substrate in the liver that actually clears hormones. So they have all these hormones that are made, and they can't clear it. So, you know, we take a step back and look at this and go, wow, this is really a complex syndrome, and it's not related to a single nutrient deficiency. And a lot of people that have this, just going off carbs may not be effective for them, even though it will be for a lot, but for some it won't. So what do we do to unwind this whole thing? And one of the first things we do is we put individuals on a limate fast, and that's basically they drink water. They make a mixture of water with lemon lime juice, a little bit of maple syrup, and some green tea. And they make a couple gallons of this. And the key with this is they drink this every 10 to 15 minutes. That's important. And if they go past 10 to 15 minutes, like an hour or two, they actually go into a fasting state, which is adverse to their treatment. So every 10 to 15 minutes, they just sip this all throughout the day, and we have them do this for like 3 to 5 days. And what that does is that simple sugar that they drink all day, every 10 to 15 minutes, keeps their blood sugar level stable. That simple sugar then gets into the cell so they can get their glucuronic acid levels up so they can start clearing out their hormones. Now they're off all their inflammatory foods that their body's reacting to, so their intestinal tract can actually heal.
So that doesn't spike insulin levels?
No, with the simple sugar that's it's given every 15 to 20 minutes won't necessarily spike it. It's really the immune reaction that's really been shown to spike the insulin levels. People that have a greater histamine surge, for example, they start developing sensitivity to grains or to dairy. They get this huge surge. The amount of carbs they have can be significant, but a simple sugar that's taken all throughout the day doesn't have that effect.
No cravings or hunger or anything like that?
Well, I think people will get some hunger throughout the day, but as they get hungry, they just have to take big chugs of water out of their, yeah, their drink. And after about a day or so, they kind of get used to it. And, you know, usually the second or third day, people feel great. And a lot of people, even after 3 or 5 days, feel so good, they want to continue. So it's been one of these things we do just to kind of break this vicious cycle between these hormonal surges, the insulin surges, the intestinal response, the intestinal tract permeability, the immune response, and just wind them down. And you'll have a lot of people that do this that just, you take a picture of them before and after, and it looks like they've been to Tahiti for 3 weeks. It looks like they're younger, they're healthier, their inflammatory response has gone down. But the key thing with that is to take sips every 15 to 20 minutes.
Right.
Now, when they're sleeping or if they need to take a nap, it's no big deal because their metabolic demands are less. They don't need that constant supply. But a constant, simple, non-antigenic, non-anti-inflammatory source of sugar all throughout the day seems to just dramatically wind down these individuals. Now, that works great for people that are insulin resistant, that fatigue after meals. That doesn't work good for hypoglycemic. They actually crash when they do a fast like this. So,
oh, yeah.
We only recommend that for the insulin resistance people.
Yeah, I have reactive hypoglycemia, and that sounds scary to me.
Yeah, that might not be for you, yeah.
Well, and then you transition them to a phase two, which is an anti-inflammatory diet, which also looks very familiar to the people who listen to this show. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, in the second stage, that's the first stage, we're there for 3 to 5 days with the limate fast. Second stage, we put them on a diet that's just non-inflammatory. They avoid wheat, dairy, soy, eggs, nightshades. And then we have them take support nutritionally to support the liver clearance, things like sulfur, amino acids, B vitamins, different botanicals like mucilage and all these things that just support the liver clearance pathways. And then at that point, we use supplements to really work on their insulin resistance. And like we mentioned earlier, chromium, B vitamin, and osteol, all these things, and that gets those receptor sites to start kicking in. And we use some botanicals that help modulate the cortisol release, things like ashwagandha, rhodalia, Brucia diffusa, and all these things, you know, because they're starting to be used in the second phase, start really getting this vicious cycle under control. And, you know, that's the second phase. And the third phase, it's really a provocation, because a lot of people that have blood sugar-related issues and autoimmune disorders have multiple food sensitivities. And what we do in the third stage is they've been avoiding all these inflammatory foods, and then we just have them introduce them back in their diet and see if they have any reaction to them. And it's very clear to see if they do. When they've had several weeks off of being exposed to the food, the reaction becomes much clearer to see. And then we can see what foods they have to avoid for a period of time.
Yeah, there were two things that you listed in phase two that I was very impressed with. As far as the things to avoid, you had, you know, obviously alcohol, soy, peanuts, eggs, all the things that might be people might be allergic to. But one of the things that you listed was beef that is not grass-fed. And I think that's an important distinction. People are like, well, why should I have the higher quality of beef? Isn't beef just beef? And yet you put that in there. As an important caveat. And then the other caveat that you put in there was be mindful of your tolerance level for carbohydrates with hypoglycemia or insulin resistance when talking about fruits, vegetables, beans, and other carbohydrate sources. So good job at least recognizing that. Too many books just throw those things in there and say eat away, and yet it's not for everybody.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that's really common to see is that people that they assume since they're, you know, they assume they're eating well just because they are not eating fast food all day.
Right.
And there's people that have severe blood sugar disorders that are eating organic, healthy foods all day, but they're eating too much sugar, they're eating too much fruit. They're not getting enough substantial protein or fiber in their diet. And they have their effects too. They have problems. You know, if someone's drinking a huge fruit smoothie all day, they're going to have insulin surges and have blood sugar problems. So, you know, it is important to be mindful of fatigue after meals. It's very important to be mindful of crashing in the afternoon or getting shaky, lightheaded, and irritable between meals, because these are just signs that even though the food may not be a fast food or it's considered a bad food, it's just having an impact on blood sugar stability. So that's critical to evaluate in these types of conditions.
Yeah. Well, I only have one more question for you, and it has to do with the hormone, thyroid hormone replacement prescription medicines that are out there. We really haven't touched on those yet.
Sure.
I know arguably the most popular one, there's two of them that are very popular. So was it Synthroid is the synthetic thyroxine, and was it T4?
Yeah.
And then the Armour thyroid, which is desiccated pig thyroid, basically, which is actually very hard to find these days. So for some reason, the manufacturer is having a battle right now, I guess, with the FDA over it. Tell us, are these appropriate medications for people to be taking?
Well, let me answer this. You know, the interesting thing is when people have a thyroid disorder, and you hear their histories, they all have a thyroid replacement story.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is they go on one type of replacement, they don't feel better, and they go on the search for the next one, and they go on the search for the next one, and they go on the search for the next one. The most prescribed thyroid hormone today is levothyroxine, which is a generic form of Synthroid, and it's the fourth most prescribed drug in the United States. So it's really commonly prescribed. And so if you're in an HMO setting and they're trying to limit cost, you're usually given levothyroxine. If you're seeing a conventional healthcare practitioner, they'll probably that isn't on a insurance plan, they'll probably give you Synthroid. And then what happens with people is they start with levothyroxine or Synthroid. Then they hear all this buzz that, you're not actually taking bioidentical, that you're not taking a T3 hormone, because we know that they're given a T4 hormone, but the body really needs T3 to have activity. So they start going on this quest for the perfect thyroid hormone. And people that have a high TSH, that have a true hypothyroid disorder, they should be on thyroid hormones. But thyroid hormones alone aren't going to necessarily unwind their condition, because it's not dealing with the autoimmunity they have, and they're not dealing with things like the blood sugar issues and the gluten intolerance and the vitamin D's that have been associated with this condition. So, you know, I'm definitely for thyroid hormone replacement therapy when people have a high TSH and hypothyroid. But, you'll see with people that are going through this disorder that they're on this quest to find the perfect thyroid hormone, and there just isn't the perfect thyroid hormone. And a lot of people are in this mindset that Armour is better, or Nutrisystem, or Westroid, or these other things are better, and that's just not true. One of the things that I did is I wrote a whole article on this, and it's available on thyroidbook.com. It talks about different types of replacements. And the biggest issue that we see with people that have Hashimoto's, which is number one cause for hypothyroidism, is they're actually reacting to the fillers. And this is why they'll take one thyroid hormone and feel great, and then take another one and then crash. Or they'll take a thyroid hormone and then just fall apart. And we know that there are things like TH2 stimulators in some of these fillers. We know that some of these fillers actually contain gluten as their starch, as their base, so it actually triggers a reaction. And that there is really isn't, there's really trial and error. And, well, you know, you get these practitioners that become like, oh, I just, our Armour's all I use, I only use Bioidentical. And that's not necessarily the best thing, too, because one of the things we've seen with these autoimmune thyroid patients is that they actually attack their own T3 and T4 at times. Not only do they attack their own thyroid gland, but sometimes they actually attack their own thyroid hormones. And those people don't do well with Bioidentical. They actually do better with synthetic. So for me personally, I don't really have a preference for one or the other, because I've just seen people change and there isn't one thing for it. And you brought this point up with Armour. And what happened with Armour recently is the only thing that's been changed with Armour is they changed the fillers. Armour is 4.22 to 1 T4 to T3. So they change these fillers for the Armour, and if you read some of these thyroid blogs that are out there, you'll see these people that claim since they changed the fillers, it's really become worse, and they take it, they can't tolerate it anymore. Since they've changed Armour, it's better than ever, and they feel much greater. And they haven't done anything to the actual hormones. They've actually just changed the fillers. Wow. So one of the most ignored areas for patients that have thyroid problems is the fact that there's a filler issue, and there's a sensitivity to the filler. And these things will obviously take place with this person's got an autoimmune disease. If anyone has an autoimmune disease and the immune system is overzealous and they keep taking the same source every single day, the immune system starts reacting against it at a greater rate than, let's say, the average person. So they start getting sensitive to the fillers. Some have it from the very beginning. And the point is, too, is when people fixate on the replacement, they're not really going on an underlying cause, which is this autoimmunity, because the replacement doesn't do anything for the autoimmunity. And then the other thing that we know is when individuals have this disorder, the autoimmune response itself is releasing cytokines. These cytokines are not allowing the thyroid receptor sites to respond. So a lot of times, despite what they take, they just don't feel better, even though they still need to take it. And if they don't take it, they get severe bone loss, they get accelerated neurodegeneration, but their symptoms like energy and weight loss and their hair coming back just doesn't improve until their inflammatory autoimmune response comes down. So the replacement battle isn't like, this is the best one, you take it, because it's not that. It's more complicated. And this is the frustration that I think I have, and we try to portray in the book. You know, we're stuck in this world of looking at thyroid disorders with this actually temperature test. And then we give people iodine, which makes these people worse. And then there's this search for this perfect thyroid hormone that just doesn't exist for them. And the underlying cause is this autoimmunity. And the goal should be to decrease the things that are triggering it and increase the things that help modulate it. And this is what we've had great effects with. Now, I've lectured all over the country and even internationally. And we've been teaching this model for the past 8 years. And we've trained thousands of practitioners all over. And we've had so many fantastic results. You know, the model we have definitely works. We've been able to help so many people. And we've, you know, you can check out some of the reviews that people have given us on Amazon that have read the book, The Thyroid Disorders. And, you know, it's really changed a lot of lives. And the goal is right now to get the message out that please don't fixate on iodine. Please don't fixate on any specific thyroid hormone, that you really have an autoimmune reaction and you don't know it because all you've been diagnosed is hypothyroid. No one's really checked your antibodies. Check your antibodies. You will see it. And then try to modulate this thing through diet and lifestyle to get the autoimmunity down.
Yeah. His name is Dr. Datis Karazian. He is the author of the book
why do I still have thyroid symptoms when my lab tests are normal? It is currently the number one selling thyroid book in the United States of America, and he has been with us today sharing all about hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, and really a revolutionary breakthrough in these that, you know, the way we've been treating it probably isn't the best way. So definitely pick up a copy of this book. And Dr. Karazian, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Visit our website at thelivinlowcarbshow.com and leave us your comments. Thank you for listening.
Disc of Light.